Anna DeVlantis joins us now. This week in Chicago history. Good morning. This is timely. A little Soldier Field history, huh?
Yeah, I love this. Happy birthday to Soldier Field this morning, Bob. This week, 100 years ago, the stadium was dedicated in this huge celebration, September 10th, 1924. So back then, huge deal. Thousands of people turned out. You had the big bands, the choirs performed. Military veterans, of course, came out in force. 3,000 children carried these illuminated lanterns across the field. It was a big deal. And a major design competition had been held to determine the architects who we know had to fill in part of the lakefront in order to create the land for Soldier Field. But back then, the controversy, it wasn't about who built it, what was built, or where it was built, but what it would be named. Went back and pulled some of the old Tribune articles, Bob, and back then it was called Municipal Grant Park Stadium, and there were factions within the city who were like, wait a minute, you want to call it Soldier Field? Why? Colonel, I mean, we understood the dedication to soldiers, but people didn't really like that name. Colonel McCormick himself had written an op-ed in the Tribune saying, Soldier Field is hard to say, and which soldier exactly are we talking about? Is it Mike or Sven? Which one? So kind of interesting to think that that was the controversy. Even Gold Star mothers, the mothers of fallen soldiers, weighed in, too, because they thought they weren't so sure that a noisy stadium was the most respectful way to honor our fallen heroes. So it wasn't until 1 year later where they coalesced around the idea, named it Soldier Field. And interesting to note, while we consider Soldier Field big today, Bob, by NFL, it's not considered big by NFL standards. Back then, it was considered a behemoth. And there was an article in the Trib about how you could barely see what was going on in the field during the games, and you almost had to read the morning paper to see who won. They were like, this is too big. Now today, they're like, that's the smallest stadium. Why do they have that? Why is there no dump? Yeah. Anyway, it's interesting because it was then high school and college football until 1971 when the Bears moved in and made from Wrigley and made it their official home. We pulled a little clip for you, Bob, when you'll enjoy.
Bears fans didn't care that Soldier Field was old or cold. Players didn't either.
When I look back and I think about the sack that I got right here, about on the 40, 30-yard line, and we were saying that it was going to be a lot of snow. The snow didn't come until after we got that sack and after we got that touchdown. And I can just remember watching Fridge wave his hands up in the air and that big gap in his mouth and the fans wearing gloves so you can't hear them, but you hear this roar.
Richard Dent. I never was aware that there was a controversy about the naming of Soldier Field. Maybe somebody said, you know, people are going to call it Soldier's Field. It'll be a mess, so don't call it that.
Because that's what happened, as you know. People still do call it that, Bob.
Yeah, but that's interesting. September of 1924. Let's talk a little bit about something that I am not familiar with, the Tully Monster. Tell us about this story.
Okay, this is a great answer to a trivia question. This week, 1955, a local man made an incredible discovery south of the city, finding something that had not been seen or had not been around for millions of years. He found the fossil of a sea creature that once lived in Illinois. Scientists tell us that around the Maison Creek near 60 miles south near Morris, Illinois, there was this saltwater sea that ran across the state. And this that was 90 million years before the dinosaurs. So this guy who found it, Francis Tully, he went to his fossil books because he was kind of an amateur fossil adventure guy, and he couldn't find it anywhere. So he then took it to the Field Museum, and they said, wow, we don't even know what this is. This is so crazy. So it was interesting because they eventually looked into it, and they studied and found that it was a squid-like creature that grew to about a foot long and lived in that saltwater area that ran across the state. 90 million years ago. And this particular fossil was 300 million years old. And he called it the Tully Monster after the guy who found it. And interesting, Bob, because that discovery was covered. It was a big deal, and it led to a lot of fossil hunters coming to Illinois. It was kind of a tourism thing in the 50s and 60s. But then, 35 years ago, 1989, the Tully Monster Rock was named the official state fossil of the state of Illinois.
Who knew we had an official state fossil? And now we go back to the summer of 1966. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, this, Bob, something a lot of us have studied or else lived. It's a major part of history. Summer of 66, a pivotal time in the civil rights movement. Chicago was a pivotal place that summer. Dr. Martin Luther King came to Chicago to put the national spotlight on unfair and discriminatory housing practices. African-Americans were being denied home ownership through redlining. Banks weren't lending to them, making it incredibly difficult. And they were even being unfairly treated as renters, too. Lots of laws were being broken, because it turned out in the North, all that stuff was illegal, while still legal in the South. And that's why Dr. King chose Chicago, because he said even if it's legal, we're still seeing discrimination. So he decided to lead a peaceful protest through Marquette Park that summer. Very prominent march. A lot of people attended, and he marched up to real estate offices and banks. And then this week, 1966, Dr. King met with Mayor Daley, along with real estate and banking professionals and church leaders, to create an open housing agreement that eventually became considered the blueprint for the Fair Housing Act and the Civil Rights Act that passed April 10th, 1968. One week after Dr. King's assassination.
Remember when Dr. King moved in for a while on the South Side?
Yeah, back in January of that same year. So a lot of efforts to call attention to that particular cause.
Someday we'll go out of the way.
Yeah, Eddie Vedder. And we've got some history to talk about. Anna?
Yeah, Bob. So the Anthem of Hope, the Cubs fan Anthem of Hope, I call that. How many times have you sung that one, sobbing in your beer at the end of another losing season? You're like, oh, no. Wait till next year. Thanks, Eddie. Well, this week, that debuted on local radio stations all the way, that song that became kind of, the anthem of hope for Cubs fans. It was released in 2008, 8 years before they actually did win the championship, but it was released around the 100th anniversary of the last World Series win. And true story, Ernie Banks himself was hanging out with Eddie Vedder at the Cubs fantasy camp the year before, and said he urged him to write this song to keep the faith and stir up hope about the future for our Cubs. Vedder first performed it. He tried it out at a concert at the Vic, and Kerry Wood and some other Cubs players jumped up on stage to sing along with him. He kind of knew he had something there, and he performed it over two nights at the Auditorium Theater, where they recorded portions of the commercially released song there. That's why you hear people in the background, actual fans, it sounds like, singing along during the chorus. Fast forward 8 years later, it was reworked into a Bud commercial and an ad celebrating the Cubs the year they won. And they somehow, through the remarkable nature of editing, got Harry Carey into the video. I think we have a little clip here.
Here it is.
Hello again, everybody. Harry Carey of Cleveland. It's such a pleasure to see you, especially on a noteworthy night indeed. The Cubs 3 outs away from winning. Boy, if you've got a weak heart, set off. The rest of you stay with us. The crowd quiet. Now ready. The pitch. Bouncing ball. There's a throw. He is out. Cubs win. Yeah! Cubs win. Cubs are the champions.
That's what he would have sounded like, and that YouTube video has been viewed more than 100 million times.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah, Harry Carey, of course, wasn't with us then, but they made it seem like he was, because he was with Cubs fans in spirit, so they had him calling last out, Bob. I think it's such an incredible video. If you want to go back and watch it, it's worth it. 101 million or whatever it is. You know, I mean, it is worth it watching it. It's just such a well-done video that, cool to see.
People around here still buzzing about Pearl Jam at Wrigley Field, too. Talking about the Cubs, we have to mention an historic game for Jake Arrieta back in 2015.
Yeah, another Cubs one for you, Bob. This week, 2015, August 30th, a big night for Cubs pitcher Jake Arrieta, who was having a big breakout year that year. He won the National League Cy Young Award. Just momentum all around him, all season building. And this week, 2015, Arrieta threw his first career no-hitter at Dodger Stadium during a Sunday night game, and we pulled the call.
He strikes out the side in the ninth inning, and Jake Arrieta has thrown his first career no-hitter. What a masterful performance by Arrieta tonight.
would make sense that his last strikeout comes with the slider, a pitch so nasty, so dirty, Don Mattingly even said earlier, this is a pitch, one of the toughest in all of baseball.
Yeah, 2015, he had that streak. He was just unhittable for a while, wasn't he?
So amazing. And then he continued the next year to be a key player in the Cubs World Series win, too, Bob. So incredible to think about that.
And finally, we go back to 1994 for Maxwell Street history.
Bob, did you ever go to Maxwell Street? Did you ever go over there and get anything? Yeah,
I remember being there. I can smell the pork chops and the sausage grilling as I speak and remember.
Isn't it funny when I talk about it? It isn't about the stuff you bought. It's about the smells and the food that you ate.
Right.
People remember some of the sizzling red hots and all the ethnic foods because there were so many cultures positioned there selling stuff. It's for 100 years leading up to 1994, it was this massive multicultural bazaar right there, kind of centered around Halsted near Roosevelt on Maxwell Street, of course, but right around there. But it grew over a mile in its heyday. You could buy everything. I always remembered it because in high school, if you got your bike stolen, you go to Maxwell Street to buy it back. That's kind of the way it works.
Exactly.
So you're kind of like, well, wait a minute, I know where to go. And then you get in the car and your friends would drive it. But that's not part of the story. There was just so much going on there, but you know, you had like the people who just brought their card tables. It wasn't real professional or all buttoned up in places, and that's kind of what made it special. Anybody of any background could come and kind of sell things back in the day. There were professional stalls too, and it was also a mecca for up and coming musicians, blues and jazz singers who were playing to try to get noticed, and so many examples of just great, great music that you'd hear there. I don't know, maybe all that would have continued. I don't think it would have survived COVID, but it certainly gave way because there was a crime element there. There was sort of a urban expansion. The Dan Ryan Expressway kind of moved it, cleared part of it in the 50s. And then UIC expansion and the athletic field cleared part of it again in the 80s. So 1994, it shut down. I know there's still a small kind of one there now again. They brought it back.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing like the ones from back then.
No.
And I don't know if you can go there to get your bike or not. I'm not sure.
Sundays on the old Maxwell Street. Nothing was like it. Thanks, Anna. Talk to you next week.